Welcome back to another episode of the Electrify Expo podcast. This one is all about Electrify's Industry Day, held this season at Circuit of the Americas Velocity Lounge in Austin, Texas. Industry Day is a unique industry-only event where thought leaders, e-mobility pioneers, and legacy car manufacturers can share insights on America's ever-changing mobility landscape. One of those panels was called From Pumps to Plugs, The Future of Keeping Us Charged, and featured Tanaz Banasadre, the CEO of Shell Group's Greenlots, Stuart Gardner, Program Director of Generation 180, Michael Rice, the co-founder of Automotive Power, and our own Matt Teske, the founder of Chargeway, which is an app that takes the confusion out of EV charging by replacing engineering terms and acronyms with simple colors and numbers. The panel was moderated by Lauren McDonald, longtime industry analyst, Clean Technica columnist, and owner of EVAdoption.com. Now enjoy this exclusive Industry Day panel from Electrify Expo Austin.
All right. Are we ready? Are we pumped? Are we supercharged? All right, we're going to get you plugged into the future of EV charging with this panel. So I'm not going to say we got to know each other real well at the event last night with a few beers, but maybe we did. All right, we have a lot to cover, so let's go ahead and dive in. Let's meet our newlyweds, if any of you are old enough to get that that anecdote. So let's just go down the path here and say who we are and what we do.
All right, hello. So my name is Tanaz Banasadre, which I don't expect anyone to say. I am the Chief Operating Officer for Greenlots, which is an EV charging infrastructure software company.
Hello, my name is Matt Teske, and I'm the founder and CEO of Chargeway, and we have developed out a simplified way to explain how all charging works using colors for plug types and numbers for power level. Higher number, faster charge.
My name is Stuart Gardner with the clean energy nonprofit Generation 180 out of Virginia. I lead a program called Electrify Your Ride, which works to drive awareness and consideration for electric vehicles.
And this is Michael Rice. I am the co-founder and COO of Automotive Power, or AMP. We manage energy. We empower everything from in e-mobility, from scooters to aircraft, to become electrified.
All right, great. So we've divided this up today in sort of two ways. We're going to have hopefully about four or five questions that we're going to try to do a deep dive on with the panel. And then if my timer works and everything, we're going to go into sort of a lightning round and wrap up with several sort of quick questions so we get in as much as possible. So let's start off, and Matt, I'll throw this one to you since rumor is this is a topic you're passionate about, which is the topic of education and awareness. And, you know, as anybody, most everybody in this room knows, the way you refuel a gas and ICE, as we love to call it in the industry vehicle, is incredibly different than how you refuel an electric vehicle. With a gas car, it's a distributed model, right? You drive it down to either empty or quarter tank, whatever your brain cells are comfortable with, and you go to a gas station and take it up to full. With an electric car, you basically, it's a distributed model. Most of us, we drive into our garage, plug in, and replenish the miles that we used the day before or that day. But most of the world doesn't know that. 99.9% of the planet doesn't understand that. You don't understand that until you actually own and drive an EV. So the first thing, Matt, and we'll start with you on this, is how do we educate not just consumers, but how do we educate the people in, like, Washington, policymakers that are making decisions about how to spend billions of dollars, and they're probably going to spend it the wrong way. So how do we educate these two groups?
I think the thing always comes to my mind about this topic is, I mean, look at the first word of the name of the expo we're at, Electrified, and we talk about electric cars. And I think the thing that oftentimes gets overlooked, we talk about awareness and education and outreach. And I think in reality, what we need to remember is that people already naturally want to buy and own cars, and they've done that for a century. And the comfort of that has been backstopped by another product, which has been the fuel that is very simple and reliable to use. So if we're going to talk about educating, whether we're talking about policymakers, the public, or even for our own purposes as stakeholders in the industry that are collaborating, we need to remember that topic of they don't need to know about the fact that a car exists. They need to know that they have a fuel option. I think that's number one, and because the competitive product is called regular. I mean, honestly, that's what it is. And so if we try to introduce the educational concept of here's a bunch of technical information to them about how to use this other new fuel, immediately it's difficult for someone to want to embrace it. They might even fall in love with the car, but the fueling experience may end up being what is, which I feel is the linchpin, makes them say, this wasn't for me. And I think that at the end of the day, there's a lot of part of this conversation. Most people don't know what they don't know, and people are making a lot of assumptions. And so we need to be very strategic as to how we are educating. And I think number one is simply not about awareness just for the cars themselves, but awareness for fuel choice. I think that is number one. And that's still very, very lost in our conversations about education. And then beyond that, it's how do you explain how this new fuel works compared to what you described, which is it is not distributed. It is. It's something that you can do at home. Those pieces down the sales funnel to me matter. So it's awareness and then simplification. Those are two key things to that, I think.
I would add, you know, awareness absolutely is important, but it's important to highlight that the car buyer is evolving and changing. Not too long ago, people were saying, oh my God, what's going to happen with new car sales? Millennials, they care about their phone. They don't care about cars. But the fact is now millennials make up 36% of new car buyers, so more than the baby boomers do. And this demographic, they're used to plugging in their lives. So very much of that kind of as this trend continues, you know, millennials who will start buying electric cars, that's already in their mindset. They're used to that habit. They'll start doing that. And it's an easy transition or easier than perhaps the baby boomers who were, you know, that's kind of a little bit more foreign concept.
You know, let me add too. I come from the ad business from many years back. And I thought Ford was really spot on with how they approached the subtle way of educating people on why EVs, right? Like, we all get too technical and too in the weeds with how we try to explain it. Ford just went right at one of the simple pain points for consumers for them to go, oh, crap, really? I could do that? Okay, well, I want an EV right now. You know, and I think sometimes it's that simple messaging from whomever in the industry. It could be any number of people have their angle in it. But it needs to be simple to the consumer of why. Like, even having a shot of a car just sitting there overnight, charging. Like, I'm at the gas station right now. I mean, coming up with that really elegant messaging, I think, is a key to helping educate people.
Yeah, and I would actually fully agree with that in terms of making it simple and making it something that is tangible enough. I mean, what people seem to think, and at least this is, you know, we talk about it in such a transformational way that people think it's such a big change, when fundamentally it's still a car. Right? And so it's making people understand that, okay, this is just a slight tweak. Instead of, you know, premium, you're getting unleaded, you're getting diesel, it's still a car. I mean, my dad is on his third Tesla, I think. My mom is still terrified of that car. She won't drive it. She refuses. Because she's like, I don't know how it works. I'm like, it's still a car. And that's the part we miss. And so, yes, I think the new generation for them, it's easier. But at the same time, it's really letting people know that, okay, it's exactly what you're used to, but with benefits. Now, you aren't reliant to go to the gas station. You can charge at home. You can charge at Starbucks. You can charge wherever. So it's exactly all that and a little bit better.
That's a good one. One of the things that I think we've done almost a disservice to ourselves as an industry is we went out of our way to talk about how EVs are different. Yeah. Right. And I think that ended up backfiring. Because
exactly.
It's like, no, it's, you said, it's just a car. That's, yeah. I mean, just don't be scared. It's just a car. But it created some of the scenarios you're talking about.
But, and maybe I'll start with you, with Michael, on this one. But the second part of this is, it is the charging aspect actually is really complicated. Like right now, it's sort of like the Rubik's Cube of, you know, multiple connectors, multiple levels. Like, you know, we even have, I discovered this in talking to another charging app company that when they talk to their customers, on the East Coast, people say level 3. In the rest of the country, they say DC fast charging. So we can't even agree on
soda and pop.
Yeah. So, but Michael, so because maybe this gets in not technical, but gets into the technical aspects. Like Tanaz said, like when you go take your gas-powered car to the gas station, you basically your options are sort of, you know, regular, medium, and premium. Maybe there's sort of different names to it. But with electric vehicles, you know, people start talking about J112 and like levels and all this stuff. And people don't know what any of that stuff is yet. Where when you were 2 years old, when your parents took you out in the car, like you saw the gas station, you saw how easy it was. So how do we fix this sort of morass of different you know, names and technologies and connectors and brands and stuff and make it a really simple process.
Yeah, I heard it on the previous panel when we were talking about building the, you built the railroad car and now you're trying to build the tracks. It's kind of the scenario we're in now with EVs and charging too, is that we're trying to catch up to, we want to build an EV. Oh crap, we need to have charging to have an EV. But then how do we simplify it? We overcomplicate, right? We're kind of an engineering industry, yeah, right? That tends to want to geek out on how I name it, what I do. I always call it Bubba-fy, right? I'm that's my old school. I'm from the Midwest. Like, you Bubba things, which means make it super simple for everybody to understand what it is. Get out of the way, right? So I think as an industry, we just need to be better at everything is simpler. How do you charge? What you charge? Like, where? All of these things needs to be more simple for the average user to get.
Yeah, approachability. J whatever and DC fast charging and kilowatt hour. And it's like, I was already a little bit hesitant about electric vehicles, and now there's all these.
Now I have to learn a new language.
Yeah. And so, you know, no one driving a Camry knows that their compression ratio is 13 to 1. And you don't need to know that your EV, you know, what their kilowatt battery power is. So it's making it very approachable, totally.
I agree. And everyone is making a case for chargeway on this panel. I'm very excited about it. So that's all I have to say.
Are we talking colors and numbers?
Well, again, the running theme, even in the last panel, it kind of took a sidestep over into education again about even shared mobility and owned and what that means for that process. And I think that, but one of the things you brought up too about the simplification, it's not simplification in multiple ways of simplifying it. If we rely on every brand to figure out their own way of simplifying, then we still end up having this weird, you know, problem of like, well, this is French, this is Spanish, this is German, and that is still not going to help. So it can't be about the simplicity from the perspective of who's trying to make it simple. I think there's a way to make universality work here because the fossil fuel industry figured it out. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I was going to actually go down
make
that
it
path,
quick.
Which, sorry, okay. but I was saying, it's also about that simplification of the entire process for the customer, right? Like roaming networks, making it accessible. It's how do you make it accessible and easy? And so part of it is simplifying. Part of it is not having three different interfaces to charge from, which nozzle do I pick? Part of it is, oh, I can go to this charger, but I can't go to that charger, or I have to download 5 more apps. It's all of that. It's about accessibility too.
So we'll stick with you, Tanaz, because we're going to talk about gas stations. So, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about sort of the difference between EV charging and the gas station model, most people actually don't understand that gas stations don't really exist anymore. Really, the gas station industry has morphed into convenience stores. I think it's 90% of the gas pumps in the U.S. are located at convenience stores. So it's really morphed into a retail industry where you go get coffee and actually no longer the hot dog on the roller. It's now you get like sushi inside. It's really changed, right? So
you Bay Area people.
Yes, yes, yes.
I was gonna say, what gas station you get?
But the model has really sort of morphed. And so this is sort of a two-part question is, you know, a lot of the, you know, Shell, Greenlots, Circle K, 7-Eleven, they're all rolling out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of DC fast chargers at their locations. So two-part question, what does sort of the gas station convenience store of the future look like, transition to charging? And then the second part is just what does the future location of EV charging look like? Those might be two different answers.
Different but related. So yeah. I think if I talk firstly about what does the future gas station look like? I mean, you're right. Shell is one of the biggest retailers
right.
in the world. And that's not gas provider, it's retailers. And if you look at it, what you're seeing is, I think the gas station increasingly becomes a hub of activity, right? And that's the best way I can talk about it. So yes, you can, you know, it's omni energy, let's say. So you can use whatever you need to fill up your car and make it and power your car, let's say. It does have, you know, coffee, it does have this, it does have that. It does account for dwell times. It does account for these things. Now, it's still not the place you necessarily want to go. I don't ever remember liking going to a gas station when I was a kid. But it's increasingly becoming like an element of utility, right? And it's how do I get to do the various things I need to do? Now, going to what you're saying about kind of what role does that play in terms of it, if you want a functioning electric vehicle ecosystem, you need a lot of different elements in there. And that goes back to what I was saying. In some ways, it's more convenient than a regular car because I can fill this up at home, and you know, I can't do that with a gas car. But at the same time, you know, what that means is you also want that accessibility everywhere, and that convenience retailing and gas stations is part of that. If you think about how these networks were originally planned, this is some of the best real estate out there in terms of where drivers go and where they pass through. So being able to leverage that real estate is actually, you know, to the benefit of everyone, and that's a huge asset. At the same time, you still want it at the grocery store, you still want it at the mall, you still want it at home, you want all these elements because you need to make it accessible, and that's partially going from the psychological barriers that drivers have right now in terms of what they expect, but also because that's what brings the element of convenience. That's what overcomes a lot of the barriers and challenges that we're seeing in the industry right now.
Yeah, I wanted to add that from my perspective, I think the gas model is the wrong model for EVs. And when I say that, I mean the gas stations and thinking every corner we should have this charging capability. Until EVs can charge in, you know, 3 minutes or less or whatever, that's not going to cut it. And I think the interstate model, and I love that, you know, the visibility will be good for us in adoption, so I support it 100%. But the interstate model is actually a better one, right, where you have all of these services in one place and you're traveling long distances, and you're like, well, I'm going to stop for a little while because I need to chill and get out of this car. And charging is a time constraint, right? So I'm going to go somewhere that has all these other amenities that makes it at least a comfortable experience, yep. Right? And I think that's one of the things that I'm going to see at least strategically should happen. I don't know what we'll end up doing with the money and the infrastructure, but.
Yeah, I mean, just on that, just a personal note, like I live in California, and when we would go down Interstate 5 to LA and back and stuff, there's so many Tesla superchargers that, you know, we would decide which one to stop at based on what restaurant we wanted to eat at. So we would actually plan our trip around, you know, do we want Chipotle? Do we want Harris Steak Ranch? Do we want In-N-Out Burger, right? So, and that's, again, something that people that don't have an EV don't understand yet. But to your point, Michael, it's, you know, getting people to understand that it's about that dwell time, and when you're on a road trip, like stopping and doing what you want to do. But so let's switch kind of to the part two in the next question about visibility. So one of the things that those of us in the industry despise, I'm going to use that word, about the current EV charging deployment model is you have companies selling hardware to like a coffee shop or a restaurant, and it's located back in the parking lot where there's no lights, you can't find it, nobody knows it's there, there's no signage and stuff, as opposed to the sort of the gas station convenience store model where they're on every corner, they have big digital signs and lights, you know what the price is and stuff. So is visibility, and let's go back to the previous question, this combination of visibility and what will the EV charging location look like in the future? Separate kind of from the gas station question. Whoever wants to take that one.
A couple things. You know, there's 150,000 some gas stations in the United States, so great opportunity, great real estate. It's very natural. People are used to going there. According to the Fuels Institute, I think two-thirds of the revenue comes from the pumps, but two-thirds of the profit comes from inside the store. So
cigarettes,
gas stations.
Cigarettes and coffee. Yeah.
For some, maybe, yeah, or health, yeah, food and.
Or sushi.
You're at the sushi place, right?
Sushi.
So a huge opportunity for gas stations to future-proof their business. Yeah. You know, the average age of a car is 12-ish years, so there's going to be gas cars on the road for a while. But gas stations should be thinking now about making their locations somewhere people want to go and want to spend time. So free Wi-Fi, decent food, a picnic table, thinking like that long-term. There's also a great opportunity, you know, you don't get to choose where the gas stations are, but if there's all these new chargers coming, you know, let's talk to EV owners and say, where do you want your chargers to be? You know, get more information from the people who are actually using it, and then also leverage the existing model of these, you know, 100,000 gas stations.
I think the visibility component comes back to the educational component in a lot of ways, is the fact that what they are seeing has to be something that they understand. It can't just be visible for visible sake. And I think my least favorite thing that I see, even on I-5, is that you'll have a gigantic blue sign that says fuel at this exit, and then a massive logo for each of the, you know, the gas stations. And then literally with like two wood screws at the bottom of the sign is this little thing that says EV that way. You know, and that, and all it says is EV that way. And you don't know what the power level is, you don't know what the network is, you don't know what the connector type is. That matters. And so that, but that's an education of the policymakers who are saying, oh, look, we checked a box and we got this done. And my response is, no, actually, you didn't check the box. In fact, that box is still wide open for getting done correctly. So,
Michael? I would even say that the retailers and others didn't really understand the value of the charging and what it could bring to their businesses. And I think they're starting to recognize that more now. That, well, shoot, I've got this person that's kind of captured here for 30 minutes plus, potentially. Hey, I wouldn't mind that consumer in my business. So maybe I might want them here. So maybe I might want to make them more obvious where my chargers are versus in the far back of the parking lot, but maybe somewhere up close. And that's a motivator.
But that is still an emerging thing. I mean, I think if you go to most parking lots right now, it's somewhere towards the back edge between Target and Best Buy. You know, like on that middle ground. But I agree. I mean, that's the thing, that there's an increasing sophistication that's coming as people get more and more familiar with the industry and what it can bring to the table for them. And so it is becoming more appealing. But I think it's still very early in the early days for that.
Well, and we're asking people that have not been fuel providers before to think as a fuel provider. And the best example is hotels that offer charging. It's a great amenity for them to have. But then who is behind the desk answering the phone at night when someone calls and says, hey, do you have EV charging stations? And they, yeah, I think so, sure. I have no idea how to explain them, because the person on the other end of the phone is going to say, yeah, do you have a J17727.2 AC kilowatt charger at your hotel? And that poor person behind the counter is going to go, maybe, I have no idea. And then that's when I would say, like, if you bring the simplification down for those folks, too, to know how to say, no, we have this plug type and power level here, that will help everybody understand more effectively, oh, this is how we provide fuel at our, like, our location, our business.
But then also provide them with the solutions to manage the dwell time of that.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And the dwell time, anybody knows that one of the first lessons you learn in retail is the longer somebody spends in the store, the more money they spend. So the industry is going to wake up to that with EV charging. It's going to go from, like, it's a bad idea to actually, hey, the longer people are charging in our store, it's actually a good thing.
It'll be a pendulum swing, because then it'll be, oh, crap, all my chargers are filled, and no one needs to charge anymore, and I can't get more customers in.
Yeah. So. All right, let's transition to what was touched on in the previous panel. But, you know, we talk sort of callously about, oh, EV charging is like charging your smartphone. You come home and pull into the driveway and plug in. The reality is, by my estimate, there's 35 to 40% of U.S. households that do not have convenient access to charging at home every night where they live. It's whether they live in an apartment, a condo, a downtown, urban center, when they don't have off-street parking and stuff. So I think we all agree that this is one of the single biggest hurdles to EV adoption in America, not just in America, but the world. But how do we, and we'll start with you, Stuart, on this one, how do we solve this problem of getting, for example, apartment owners or homeowners associations of condos, right, to either invest in or approve and allow EV charging at their location? Because, as Matt will say, like, these people do not believe they should be refueling centers, right? They're apartment owners. So how do we solve this problem?
Yeah, EVs have a little bit of an image problem, being just for a certain demographic and income range. And this is an excellent opportunity to kind of say, no, they're for everyone. It's an accessibility topic. So multi-unit dwelling, or MUD as the acronym is known, something that should definitely be prioritized, because you and your community should be able to benefit from everything that EVs offer. So partly from a policy perspective, there should be rules that say new construction must be EV charger ready. That's an easy thing, and then homeowners associations should not be allowed to prevent people from having chargers. So there's a policy perspective, and then property owners should realize that this is a real opportunity to attract and retain home residents. So looking at it both from a policy perspective and kind of a benefit to increase accessibility.
So I agree with that on the policy point, but the policy also has to be well laid out enough to better enable it. So California has a policy that if someone wants a charger, you have to allow it. I'm one of the people who lives in a building in a condo where I don't own the condo, and I don't have a charger, and there is no charging in the building, and I ask them about it. They do allow it. But it needs HOA board approval. I don't own the condo. My landlord has to do it. It has to be installed, individually metered to the condo, from the underground garage, et cetera, et cetera. The barriers to that are so high, and I guarantee you, like, you know, my landlord in Hong Kong is not going to care, and he's not going to let me do it. So what happens is you have the policy with best intent, but unless that policy has teeth, it's not going to get you very far.
Yeah, and I would add, I think as an industry, we need to be better at proof of concepting. Like, we were talking about this on the car right here. Like, take all the different scenarios that make sense, whether it's a retail mall or condo, and work together as a group, whether it's a developer or a retailer, and say, look, let's come up, let's proof of concept this, and then take that model and share it with everybody else and say, look, it works. Here's how it works, to that landlord's point of, like, understanding what's the economics of that. Yep. Now, maybe there's a revenue stream for them in there somewhere. That always excites people, right? But until you know that, it just feels like this big, nasty thing that costs somebody money. So I don't want to do it.
I think it's one of the things that this conversation continues to show is that we have the technology. Mm-hmm. There's so many other psychological and policy barriers that are wrapped up in making that technology get in front of the right people and show those, again, your proof of concept and showing that value proposition. So I think that that's a big part of that educational factor, mm-hmm. is really helping to, again, I think you brought up a great point of just, at the end of the day, it's really about getting the people that are in positions of authority and influence and power to understand what they can do and making it very checkboxy so they can go, oh, this is a win, it's a win, it's a win, it's a win. So.
And in the meantime, I think the one thing that you can do is, again, it's the industry working together, right? It's that accessibility factor again. So how do you make it that until a point, because this is an equity issue, and this was raised in the last panel too, right? The majority of my dwellings are, you know, in, let's say, lower income areas and so on and so forth. And so there's an equity issue here too about how do you get this to people, and those are the people who aren't necessarily going to have the bandwidth, the ability, et cetera, to go do this on their own. And this is where those broader networks come in. This is where the gas stations come in. This is where the destinations, the malls, the coffee shops come in, because that at least gives an opportunity. And this is where, again, the industry coming together and saying, let's make, you know, it's the roaming conversation. Let's make everything accessible to everyone. Let's get them all together on that.
So speaking of numbers, let's do one last big question before we go into the lightning round. How many chargers do we need? Biden says we need 500,000, but we all said that 95% of charging is done at home. So why do we need all these public chargers, and how many do we need? Michael, why don't we start with you on this one?
I mean, I think they're just taking a stab at what's solving the problem, right? And we all know, well, visibility is good, so we like that they want to put chargers out there. I think it's misguided a bit as far as, like, well, this is what we want to do and how. Maybe someone's done the math and figured out, well, if we have them at least spread out throughout the United States, that's a good number. I don't know. For me, it's too early to tell you that makes any sense at all. I agree with you. I charge at home. I rarely fast charge anywhere unless I'm traveling across states. So, you know, for me, I don't think I'm going to be visiting any of these charging stations anytime soon. So I don't know who that serves. Now, maybe if they're looking at apartments or condos or whatever, as those are the locations for these things versus just randomly throughout cities, that might make sense to me.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say 44,000 stations is not enough, but what that top number is, not sure, and I think probably the panel would agree, it's more about location and accessibility than the top line number.
It's the 500,000 number gets a good headline, gets a good attention to it. But again, it just reminds me of that scene from Office Space when he walks in for the interview with the Bobs, and in the background on the whiteboard it says "Planning to plan." Like, it's, we are building the plane as we're flying right now, and some of these high, you know, high ideas are great. But then you look at, you know, studies from like UC Davis in California, that is EV Central, and from 2014 to 2017 they doubled the amount of public charging connectors available to the public, and they did surveys in those two different years. In 2014 they said, "Is there enough public charging for you to feel comfortable to buy an EV?" Certain percentage said yes and no. In 3 years, when they doubled the amount of public connectors, more people said, no, there's not enough. So it's not if you build it, they will come. There has to be a strategy.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit of a chicken and egg there too, right? Which is, you know, the infrastructure's not there because it's not really financially viable right now to do it, but it's not going to become financially viable until you get the infrastructure. And I feel that 500,000 number is a way to get people, again, comfortable enough to say, okay, I'm going to make that conversion. Now, going back to what Stuart said, there's like 150 to 170,000 gas stations in the U.S. right now. So theoretically, you don't need more than that. But it depends on how this $500,000 is panned out. I mean, there's also significant money for buses and electrification of buses and stuff. So where are these chargers determines the number.
All right, so let's go in the lightning round. We have like 3 or so minutes left. So first question, Tesla and now Rivian have launched their own charging networks. Should all of the OEMs launch their own EV charging networks? Quickly.
No. Roaming.
No.
Yes, but they use her technology to do it. So, no.
No, stick to your core competence.
What was that? No what?
No, you should stick to your core competence. Yeah, build cars.
All right. You guys did good. You were quick. So this kind of goes back to the previous question. So I wrote an article about this. So if you look at the infrastructure bill and stuff, it's actually, I think, about $5 billion that's going to go to EV charging, the other to, like, fuel cell and natural gas, et cetera. And then there's supposed to be another $5 billion in the appropriation. So you have $10 billion. How do you spend it?
Do we have to go in order?
I was thinking.
So I would say.
Where do you spend it? Like, do you spend it on solving the apartment problem, workplace, road trip? Like, yeah, how do you spend it?
I think it's on the apartment problem.
Apartment problem, great.
Yeah, I think it's on road trip.
Yeah, I would find a worthy clean energy nonprofit and make a size. No, joking. I would say. I believe in workplace and road trip, and particularly to your point earlier, you know, there's a couple thousand rest areas on our highways. Talk about visibility
first
and accessibility.
First place to build them, yeah.
Yeah, and there's regulatory laws there, but, you know, let's find a solution.
I do like the interstate side of it, but I also like, and I mentioned this earlier, the proof of concept of literally try to blow out every opportunity for you to integrate EV and energy management throughout our lives and show how that works. So that there's less resistance on the whys, and the adoption will go through the roof, in my opinion. But we've got to show that, because everybody's resisting all along the way, not just the consumer, but everybody else.
All right, so vehicle to grid. So I think V2X, grid, building, home, load, as Kia and Hyundai call one aspect of it. I think it's a game changer. Is it a game changer? Is vehicle to grid, et cetera, going to be what gets mainstream consumers in America laggards to go, holy Christ, EVs are different from gas cars, I need to have one.
In like 10 to 15 years.
The value proposition has to be there for them to understand what they're getting for giving back something.
Totally, we work a lot with schools to help them go solar and then also get electric school buses, and there's a whole holistic model there for resiliency, and that kind of sweetens the pie to make the business case work.
It's a game changer to me, and I think Ford is showing how you can introduce it to the consumer in a very simple way. That's V2G, you know, and we just have to get there. It's going to take time to get the technology there, but it's going to be a game changer.
All right, final question. You have a magic wand. What do you do to solve the EV charging challenge in America?
Reliability. I want anyone to be able to drive up to a charger, and it works.
That's good.
I would say simplifying how we talk about it in a way that's universal and works for both automakers, networks, and drivers.
I think there's, 1.8, 1.9 million EVs on the road. If each one of those people gave their neighbor or their colleague a ride in the car to let them see what it's like and get that exposure.
Yeah, no, the experience. I want everyone to experience it. I want that to be the resistance of what an EV is, like your mom not wanting an EV because it's not a car. No, it is. So if we can get past that mental state of like, please, it's a car.
She rides in it. She just won't drive it.
And it goes really fast. But yeah, no, I want to get that barrier down, and let's move on past that. I'm resisting because it's an EV versus a gas car. Stop. Just.
All right, magic wand, and the panel is over. We hope that was valuable, and everybody is now much more plugged in. Thank you.
The Electrify Expo podcast is brought to you by the creators of Electrify Expo, America's largest e-mobility festival featuring the hottest electrified brands and products in the e-mobility sector. The Electrify Expo is coming to 5 major cities in 2022, so be sure to subscribe and don't miss out.